Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. Today is part one of our Lucha Espectacular. With Dr. Lucha Steve Sims, we talk about the recent CMLL Dos Leyendas show, the matches and where they are going forward, the news involving Elite and AAA, and then some spring training slash preseason baseball talk. Thanks for your time. Please be sure to check out part two of the Lucha Espectacular with Lucha World's Fredo Esparza. Thanks for listening. Dum, dum. Welcome back to the Winter Palace. We had a CMLLI pay-per-view the other day, and so to discuss that and some of the news in the world of Lucha Libre, plus to talk about spring training and the upcoming baseball season, it is the return of Dr. Lucha Steve Sims. How's it going, Steve?
I'm doing well. I am very happy to be back after a rather extended absence, which included some health issues, but I'm mostly recovered now. So I am good to go and looking forward to a very, very, very interesting next 6 to 9 months in the world of Lucha Libre.
Well, we'll get to the pay-per-view in a second, but apparently next week will be very interesting between Lucha Underground airing Wednesday night, while at the same time Elite will be running in Arena Mexico with somebody possibly from the Lucha Underground TV show and from AAA.
If my memory serves me correctly, I thought Elite was running the 30th rather than the 23rd, so with their first TV taping, but I could be wrong on that. But there's no doubt that their first taping has Big Brian Cage from Lucha Underground on the poster or internet poster they put together. They've got a match promised with him against Rush, which I think is a great match for insiders and very intriguing. I think in Mexico they may well look at this as like almost intra-promotional, considering that Cage has worked for AAA in challenging Alberto El Patron for the title.
Hold on. Well, you're right. It is the 30, so we'll just do that again.
Okay.
So I'll just do the whole thing again.
Sure.
Welcome back to the Winter Palace. There was a CMLLI pay-per-view this Friday, and to talk about that, some of the big news that's broken just recently in the world of Lucha Libre, and for something completely different, a look at spring training this year and the upcoming baseball season, it's the return of Dr. Lucha Steve Sims. How's it going, Steve?
It's going fine, and I promise you I don't have my 14-year-old son with me here to help answer questions on the show.
Oh, we will get to that quite
sad. That, of course,
sad.
Made most possible by the fact there's no 14-year-old son running around, but I'm sure we'll discuss the rest of the story a little later.
Right.
I have a question for you to start out with. When you're 55,
okay, that is...
when you're 55 years old, how many times are you going to fall on your neck? Deliberately.
If I get to 55, hopefully none. We cannot say that for everyone's favorite new grandfather, Negro Casas, who took quite a number of what looked like horrific bumps on the pay-per-view, but he will probably end up being just fine.
Well, in my personal opinion, I mean, a medical doctor would tell you any bump like that to the back of your head is not good. Anything. You may be able to operate with it and go on through life, but we are taking this around the one-year anniversary of the day that Hijo del Perro Aguayo passed away, and Perro Aguayo Sr. has come into the forefront lately in news, and this all ties together. And he is a living, walking example, and I saw him this, you know, in a pretty bad state when he was 55. Of what constant bumps and constant high-risk taking maneuvers can do to your joints and to your knees and your ankles, and, of course, obviously, to your brain and stuff like that. How Negro Casas gets away with this after all these years is just amazing. I have never seen anybody over 55 like this.
Well, I think it's amazing that he's still at the very top of his game when you only need to look down the card a match or two and see that Blue Panther, who up until maybe a year or two ago was still pretty much keeping up well with the other guys in matches, and he seems noticeably slower now, and it's understandable, but you marvel at how much longer Casas can be an equal to guys like Volador or Rush or Dragon Lee in matches.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm sure you watched the pay-per-view like I did, and Casas has been wrestling for, he's in maybe his 37th year in the business and stuff, and we've got somebody who is in the second match from the top, the semifinal, as they call it in Mexico, who is just starting his, or completing his 40th year in the business. And I'm not sure I've seen a wrestler walk into the ring and go through a ring entrance in a match where it's been a while since I've literally thought there's a person who could have a heart attack any second in the ring. I
Well, I
was
think.
literally scared for his health watching him, 1,000 miles away or 2,000 miles away on TV.
Well, I think someone said the other night, it's hard watching him even walk down the stairs.
It looks like, this is all he knows. We're talking for listeners, we're talking about Brazo de Plata, Super Porky. This is all he knows and all he wants to do, and he's the classic guy that you would use the cliche about he's going to keep wrestling till he dies, but he may literally keep wrestling until he dies. And from what
Well,
looked like Friday night, that's not that far away.
I jokingly said during the first hair match, it's like, does Porky really have the stamina to be out there even as a second and then have to come back a half an hour later and wrestle?
Well, that was a very good, the choice of second, although it's puzzling with CMLL, they didn't get all that involved. So if they had had more of a storyline with them, I mean, I guess the real storyline was that CMLL decided to kill their supposedly top heel gimmick, Los Ingobernables, by making the one of the two or three worst wrestlers in the promotion the newest member. I have no idea what they're thinking about that. It must be some kind of political appeasement to either the family or to Rush himself to put his father in as the replacement for Sombra. I mean, that's not a substitution of equal value, to put it mildly.
Well, I thought in both matches that the choices of seconds was just strange, and to me it took me out of the match because I was expecting more booking based around who the seconds were. I thought for sure La Máscara would be Rush's second, and then when he wasn't, I expected him to interfere. He didn't, and Rush won clean in the main event. Yes, it was Flyer, Volador Jr.'s big surprise all along, because I think,
Yeah,
I think
I
we
don't
kind
actually
of.
want to address that because a couple of people have emailed me and said Paco was slated in that position, and somewhere in the last week Paco vetoed it, and this was what they had to do to save the storyline. But the goal that Volador was speaking about up until the time where Paco vetoed it, and frankly, Volador should have known that Paco was going to veto him. I mean, there's a long history there between him and Paco. Volador in his head really thought he could get Parker out there as a second at some point in time, and during the week that was nixed. That's what
Which
I
is
think.
kind of funny. Well, what's funny about that is if you remember after the thing with Parca and Wagner happened, Volador was on Informa and basically, I don't know if he was giving the party line or he knew what was smart to say politically, but he said something to the effect of, he screwed up and he's gone and that's that. I mean, he certainly did not try and make any excuse for him.
Yeah, I think, and I from what I get, and this hasn't been directly explained this way to me, but from what I get is that the idea of using Park was to keep him or to keep a tease going and make the match more interesting. And if it turns out with Volador and Casas in there, I mean, the seconds didn't really need to get involved all that much. My general
And it.
theory on seconds in Mexico, unless they themselves have been part of the storyline of the feud that has led up to the match, you only have them out there if the match needs them to interfere to make it interesting or funny to the fan or to get to the finish. But CMLL, as you know, on its big show main events, always does clean finishes. So.
But then you could argue that if Puma or Tiger had been his second, then that actually does sort of fit into the storyline of
Yeah,
them interfering.
that does. Even it gives the fan a reason to, every time that Puma or Tiger is there, to look over to the corner, or if LA Park was there, to look over at the corner and see what dastardly things. Because Park is a loose cannon, and he can't be a Technicos second doesn't mean he still wouldn't interfere in the way that a Rudo wouldn't. So it was very interesting, but it was. The best at $10, I thought Mark was better value than some of the other pay-per-views I've seen from other promotions that were free. It was a
I
very good show and very good wrestling, and the feud only died at the end.
think the only people can hear this later when I talk to Fredo from Lucha World, that I think in my head I was expecting shenanigans in the two hair matches, and I think when they both were clean, I think that left me a little disappointed. I guess maybe I should know better. But like I said, I was expecting La Máscara to fit in somehow. I was expecting Puma and Tiger, and then unfortunately, I was expecting Super Parka to show up. Luckily, he didn't. Nor
But it
did
would have
the.
made sense. It would have made logical sense if he did. I mean,
Right.
that's who Volador's hair, well, the reason for the hair match, because he was avenging his father.
And as we said, if I remember right, Volador and whoever Casas' second was. In that match on New Year's, I think they interfered and then got thrown out, or at least were more active in the match than just being a regular
Yeah.
second standing there to help catch dives.
Catch dives and wave the towel intricately.
Unfortunately, there was no magic spray this time.
Well, you can't win them all. It was good. It
That did
was
not
interesting.
help.
I am not looking forward to in the semifinal, as Fredo will go over later. They started another feud to satisfy the ego of Ultimo Guerrero, because having him not being involved in a main event feud now that Thunder is gone leaves a gaping hole in the promotion, at least in his own mind. Well, he needed one, and so they fed him one, and I'm sure you and Fredo will discuss that at more length. But
Well,
I'm not
our
looking
question
forward to
was,
artistic matches for the next 6 months out of this feud.
is this the kind of thing where Ultimo Guerrero now has to prove to people how good a worker he is by constantly working with people of lesser skill than him? It's frightening to say that a feud with Cibernético actually improves the quality of his opponent.
It does. I got to say, I'll give Cibernético a look. He was trying. He is trying. He's literally trying to up his game. There is not much up to his game that he can do, but I mean, I'm watching him. He's clearly trying. So there's that. But yeah, I mean, there is a corner of the booking sheet in every booking sheet in the company that is reserved for Ultimo Guerrero to do what he needs. And what he really likes, and you can see it from what he's booked, is he likes to be the Rudo that is cheered. And so promoting him against another Rudo that is likely to get boos, somebody that he can be superior to in a wrestling sense, and something that will add a little luster in his mind to his career, is just the sort of thing he may do till he retires.
So both of the hair matches, I think even though the finishes were pretty much a foregone conclusion, were both, very good and could very well be leading to Volador versus Rush at the anniversary show.
Because we will see. I've heard different things. I've heard that they have something planned with Rush, but for Volador, this was like his big victory for the year, and they wanted to do a family versus family thing. But now that Volador has killed off in the storyline since the head of the family, I'm not sure there's much else that he can do in that regard. I was disappointed it didn't, draw but like 75 or 80% of the house, since this was one of the two shows that people who don't go to shows regularly would go to as one of their two big shows of the year. And they were assured of and got three fabulous matches, and three matches that were, for their position on the card, were fine, were acceptable. And they got clean finishes, and they got losers, and they got a chance to, I know it was rushed at the end, but a chance to remember an old legend. I'm very surprised they weren't able to sell out from this. But eventually not having TV locally was going to catch up with them, and apparently in the last 6 to 12 months it has.
Yeah, the other good match that you mentioned was Team Mexico versus Team Japan, and that was another one that I thought the booking was sort of strange, in that I think we all expected the Team Mexico to win, but for the two pins to be Valiente pinning Okamura and Dragon Lee pinning one of the new guys seems strange, that if Kamitachi is indeed leaving, that he did not.
Yeah, and I think that maybe you may have hit the nail on the head. I wouldn't be surprised if they did have a different finish, with Dragon Lee finally once and for all sending Kamitachi home, and that for the third time in less than a year, Kamitachi has pulled the rug out on his plans to go home. Or he's, I mean, it's just, you know this, New Japan just doesn't book him. I mean, he is the sort of size and style that New Japan just doesn't have any use for. He can work in Mexico for the rest of his life. He could be on the WWE's Cruiserweight tournament. But New Japan, with their current philosophy, just doesn't have a place for him. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's a long time before he goes back there. Really, I really wouldn't.
And he did at least, do the job to Mystico in the second fall. So I think...
I know that, and I know other people took it differently, but I just took it as the Mystico has to go over once clean right in the middle in front of everybody because he's the one we charge the most for on the road, sort of thing. That's all I took that for. And other people have taken it differently, and they could be more right than I am. But I just figured that's one of the falls that's coming up naturally. But
Well, I've said this before, and I think I said this with Fredo, is, in my dream scenario, Kamitachi, I think, is the perfect new member of Los Ingobernables, because he has the style and he also has the skill level to fit in.
I would like to see that. That would be fine for me. I'd like to see Fujin and Rajin in a feud with a couple of younger guys. And to be honest, as much as this is, and I have gone on and on and on and on and on, in other places about Dragon Lee and Kamitachi being the best feud in the world the last 18 months, the best matches in the world, in my mind, the last 18 months, it's time for Dragon Lee to have a new opponent and move up the ladder in his business. And there, this is not the only person you can ever work with, a Japanese mid-carder.
Well, hopefully the match on Tuesday will actually somehow make it online, because he is perhaps starting a feud with Cavernario.
Yes. If Cavernario continues to destroy his body with his work rate, I would be doing a lot of feuds with him in his 20s, because he's not going to be around in his 30s to feud unless he's the next coming of Negro Casas. But I do hope it eventually gets up on TV. I mean, between periscopes and cell phone videos and whatever, I hope so. I'm thinking positive thoughts.
It is funny, I thought, that it seems like the two new Japanese guys are a lot higher on the card than I would have expected two new guys from New Japan to be. Because there are, I mean, this was
yes,
different.
They are.
But it
no
seems like they're already...
It sticks out.
And I could almost say the same thing with seeing Karis's two kids getting on a pay-per-view already and already getting a push. And you can certainly tell that they're going to be good, but, they're already sort of getting pushed higher than a lot of teams that have been there for quite the while. including Kool-Aid
true.
Tiger,
It
who.
would indicate that there's somebody in the booking committee that is in charge of or has enough juice that's saying at least out of the top two matches in the cards, we got to put some new faces and new guys and new people in there. I know the CML organization as a whole, the office is a very very there's many close friends there of the Hermanos de Namita family, and they are willing to give the kids a try and see if they can do it. But the Japanese, and of course, they're in their rookie year, so they've got a while to go. Maybe one of the two of them will win the Grand Alternative Tournament, the rookies tournament that's coming up.
Not
Hope, yes, hopefully it's not
okay.
Super Hao Hong Jr. Although,
And we are apparently getting a new Casas in the tournament too.
just what we need. I'm waiting for them to put. Well, they are. They are. They're, they has. Pl they have good plans for Puma and Tiger. They heard nothing to countermand what I've heard from towards the tail end of last year. This was going to be a next step up the ladder year for Puma and Tiger. But I certainly hope he's better than Canelo Casas or Danny Casas, or I
Well,
hope he's one of the better half.
the good thing is that he is at least a new guy, more or less, and he's not. I think we all were sort of afraid that it was Canelo Casas with a new gimmick.
No, it's not. It's apparently not that. And this is March, and in years past, April, in fact, even late March, but it's not going to be late March this year, but or April has been when they've announced the Busca de Ídolo entrance. I suspect this year it's going to be a little later than that. It just looks like their whole calendar is later this year, except for Dos Leyendas. They're just not quite as they kind of push things further back than usual. But a lot of that, I think, has to do with Elite. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the fact that Elite, now that it's got television, is going to be asking for dates for its guys. And they have to work around that and say, well, if Rush is going to be on the main event on TV this coming weekend for Elite, maybe we don't want them in the main event this Friday night in Mexico, et cetera. Just balancing things out. So, like, in the main event in Tuesday night or Monday night or something like that. So they may have known this was coming and had to do a lot of interesting calendaring on their Microsoft Office calendar.
Well, as you mentioned, Elite made news twice last week. Once was announcing a new TV deal with a channel that apparently gets them better penetration than CMLL does. And then the very next day, they announced for their debut Wednesday show that they're bringing in Brian Cage from Lucha Underground.
Yep, but I have two thoughts on that. The first is on the TV itself, being on TV Azteca 7, they're only running Mexico City, Puebla, and Guadalajara as a promotion now. They're booking out their guys to other cities, but the shows they're running are just Mexico City TV audience encompasses Puebla, and so they really only got to have TV on a station for the moment. TV on stations that reach Mexico City, Guadalajara, and maybe some of the bigger cities in the provinces around the country. They don't have to have a Televisa Channel 9 that broadcasts to 99.99% of all homes in Mexico. The Channel 7 does get into I think all cable systems in Mexico City and in Guadalajara. So that'll be good. It'll be good. Now, what how CMLL works things so that, for example, if Rush is going to be in their anniversary show main event, and Brian Cage isn't, let's just assume he isn't. I don't know, I have no idea if he is or not. But if he isn't, then does Brian Cage have to go over, or does he have to lose? Does CMLL have any influence over the rest, the finishes that the wrestlers take to give to Elite? There's a lot of news that's going to come, and a lot of it's going to come really early in the first month that Elite runs. They should be able to pick up patterns in what they can and can't do with the guys that they book. And of course, like as you teased, whether or not they have a tie-in with Lucha Underground, with Conan, with the people like Hijo del Fantasma and Brian Cage and Johnny Mundo that are Conan excuse me, are very close to Conan, that will, I would think, would make itself obvious in the first month to in April.
This is something we were talked about, and so I'll get your thoughts on this. I had asked the other day, and this is before this news came out, that what would happen if somebody that was in AAA that was also in Lucha Underground wanted to jump to CMLL and Elite? Like, how restrictive are the contracts? And, wrestling contracts are one thing, but American television contracts are probably as ironclad as you can imagine. So, because I guess the person I was thinking of when I sort of raised this question and asked all of you guys was, is Sexy Star, who theoretically has retired from wrestling, quote unquote, and left AAA, but is still, I assume, on Lucha Underground TV, probably for the rest of the season they've already filmed, and may be in season three whenever that starts filming. Like, could she jump to Elite if she wanted?
That's a very good
And then
question.
that is, so, and then that, and then my other question that we were talking about is, would Lucha Underground care if one of their people left AAA and went to CMLL? Because theoretically, that's not being seen in America, at least right now on television. So,
Which brings up another question. If it will, as America, decide to broadcast this show once it becomes available. We don't know that yet.
and another sort of tangent to that question would be, would Lucha Underground care if one of their wrestlers who has their own Lucha Underground gimmick that's different than their regular gimmick in Mexico, would they care if that person theoretically jumped and were to go to Elite? For example, the name that seems to be in the news is El Hijo de Fantasma, who is not El Hijo de Fantasma in Lucha Underground.
Yes,
So,
and you're right. It gets very, very interesting from there because his real first name is Jorge. So the answer to the question is, can Jorge work as Jorge in CML Elite? Is he banned as his under his real name there? Is he banned under the El Hijo Fantasma name? Is he banned just for the King Cuerno name? If he comes up with a fourth name, is that allowed? It's very interesting. I mean, we see Lucha Underground wrestlers work like independent shows. You'll see Willie Mack show up on something, and you'll see Rey Mysterio Jr. work show up on something that's not on AAA or CMLL. So they're letting the guys work other promotions in other countries that aren't showing TV in the U.S. already, I guess.
and you mean you had the guys win King of Trios in Chikara last year.
Well, you're right. I mean, that's one of the reasons why for the month of April, once WrestleMania is done, Elite may be the world leader in wrestling news because so many interesting things can devolve from this. Unlike, say, just a regular old AAA pay-per-view coming up this week, or even strength training baseball, where we basically already know that, which teams don't have a chance. Padres of competing in for a division title this year.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that this weekend is like the anniversary of Perro Aguirre Jr.'s death, and I mean, when we did our Lucha Year in Review shows, we mentioned like sort of what an incredibly insane down year it was for AAA, and as Fredo said, a year ago this time, all of the arrows for AAA were pointing upwards.
That's right.
And now it's like, not only do you have the anniversary of Perro's death, and then the woman that died in the bus crash the same week, but if you think about it, it was like a year ago when the AAA Dream Team was Rey, Alberto, and Mysticis, and now, we have Carístico back in CMLL and Elite. You have Alberto went back to WWE, and Rey, one, there's you never know when Rey's knees will give out, And two, he's having apparent problems with AAA, and there are some people who said, Ray could be back in WWF by SummerSlam.
Well, that's
So it's
funny.
like,
I wonder who said that.
yeah, I wonder who said that.
I have an even bolder prediction for you. I would not be surprised if by the end of next year the AAA is out of business. That they've either one of three things, either, and this is I think the most likely, they've sold the promotion to Televisa and Televisa calls it something else. And Televisa works with someone else as its main contacts there. B, they've just merged with other promotions in Mexico like Elite. Or C, their financial income just is not enough to cover expenses, and they look at each other about a year from now and just close the doors. That's, I
Well, of
think that's the
course,
least
my.
likely but not impossible scenario because I never hear good news coming out of their front office.
Well, I mean, my running joke last year as people kept leaving was, is Konnan going to be the last person to turn out the lights when everybody else is gone? But of course, it looks like he won't be there when the lights are off anyway.
That's true.
If.
That's
You know, if
another.
you assume this, yeah, the stuff with the Roldans and him and his Twitter feud with Arturo Rivera are anything to go by and aren't some sort of massive, it's like, I think I'm conditioned to expect any sort of Twitter feud to be a work, especially in Mexico. So.
Yes, by the way, can I just add, if there's any kids here under the age of 18, you don't want to go on Arturo Rivera's Twitter feed. Your parents will take away your phone or your iPad or whatever. So under no circumstances go to at Rudo Rivera. Don't do it. Whatever you do, don't do it. Anyway, now that I've just killed half of our under 16 or under 18 age listenership, just go see what's there.
Okay, it's not
It's
like I don't, it's not like most of my Twitter while watching CML is not half filled with various Edicanes in whatever sort of wacky outfits.
look,
If they're
but
dressed like 50s,
Ali
if they're dressed
Shamar
like
and all
50s.
these others are classy. I mean, Rudo Rivera is, that's just, you can go look for yourself. That's all I gotta say.
I was going to say, you and I are two of the only people who would have appreciated the Edicanes dressing up as 1950s diner roller skating waitresses this week on the pay-per-view.
Carrying the whatever it was on the trays in their right hands. Oh my goodness, it's fun. It's fun being a fan of Lucha Libre because, kind of like if you ever watch the incredibly strange wrestling shows or Lucha Volume or something like that, there's always something at every show that happens that you go, who thought of that? Nobody else in their right mind would have ever thought of that. And there's something, even if it's just with the hostesses doing a dance routine. It's very interesting. Yeah, AAA has a show coming up at Rey de Reyes this week. It's taken them 6 months, but finally they're going to determine who will be the face of the promotion and the new mega champion. And they will set up for Triple Mania, and I'm looking forward to the show, but I'm looking forward to the show more for the results, whereas with CMLL, I was looking for it more for just to see the matches and the action. So it's a very, very different style with AAA now. They're emphasizing the veterans and not the youngsters. They have a few youngsters still left, and we'll see with this show just exactly how heavily this going back with the veteran names is attitude has taken it has seeped into the Roldans that are running the company.
And for those of wondering, yes, this podcast is indeed capable of discussing AAA. So there you have it.
There you go.
Any
It's
Canadians
tough
who
to
may be
discuss it
wondering.
now, though, because actually they're in such flux right now with wrestlers with the Lucha Underground tapings and with Elite. I mean, in the article I wrote for Figure Four Weekly, the most recent article I wrote for Figure Four Weekly, I mean, they've got Averno as their tag team champion. Averno is not somebody the Roldans are ever going to push. So do you figure, yeah, he's probably is going to pull the trigger and join his friend Karrueche Tao in Elite? since without Conan, who was a big Averno fan and backer, and with just the roll dance there, that he figures is, yeah, I'm just stuck in second and third mat from the top jail for the rest of my career here at AAA. In the Elite, I can be on like TV Azteca as a star Rudo. So, you know, that might happen, that might not happen, but AAA's got to consider that fact when it decides who's its tag team champion. So there's a lot of interesting results that are going to, and a lot of news that's going to come out of AAA, but the long-term prognosis, which, you know, in the long run, we're all dead, but in the near short term, the near long term, things don't look good there. They look about as good as they do for the Padres.
Yeah. Lastly on Lucha, I'll just throw this out because this just happened to happen today. One of my friends who watches wrestling, presumably by having to constantly look at my Twitter feed, said, I don't watch Lucha, but I was thinking about it. Where should I start? And I was just sort of left. I'm like, this is such a gigantic question. And so I'll see what you think. What I first told him is, because this is like somebody I grew up with, so he's my age, and so has my sort of base of knowledge, and I guess still watches the network and stuff like that. So I said, for people that you probably still remember, like, I would watch the Worlds Collide pay-per-view, because it was like the first sort of big American exposure to, you know, this is 25 years ago, that it's full of people you know and or have heard of, especially from back then, and, you know, Tanay did such a good job of, like, getting Lucha over as a concept. I said, I think this is, like, would be a good, really rudimentary first place to start. And I said, and just go on YouTube and just start, you know, typing in people's names you may have heard of, or because he said he doesn't get El Rey, so he couldn't watch Lucha Underground. And I was like, well, they're on iTunes now. But I said, if you want to start, I said, you know, there's a jillion matches on YouTube to watch. I was like, just put some names in and start and go from there.
They so are, I would also advise somebody who's just starting out watching Lucha to take amongst the viewing that they choose to watch any week, to take one CMLL show from start to finish and just get an idea of, you know, how they work things in opening matches versus later matches, how they present stars, how the format of the cards is structured, how the format of the matches are structured, how the formats of the, you know, who wins and loses the falls is structured. I would say they would get a very, you know, just any regular 2016 CMLL show that they could watch. Not a big show, but a regular show. And then move on from there to specific matches of the characters and or the feuds that interest them.
I will do that. Although, hopefully it will not be like Puebla or the Tuesday show.
For the first one, you can say this is their standard house show. This is not their TV show. This is a standard house show that they're just filming, which is basically what Pebble is. It's not designed to have big feuds. Big feuds only happen in Arena Mexico. It's just a house show that's being filmed.
Gotcha. And as we have teased so far, you have made at least one trip to spring training this year.
So far, that's all I've made, yes. One trip
since I got my
6 days, ten teams and 8 ballparks.
Which is because it's pretty much 50-50 now, isn't it, between Arizona and Florida?
Yes, it is. 15 in Arizona and 15 in Florida.
Who amongst the teams you saw in Arizona looked the best to you? Would it be a team?
The Royals. The Royals looked like they hadn't left off. They hadn't lost a step from the World Series last year. They were incredibly. They're starters. Now, granted, I was there the first week, and the starters left after their third at bat, no matter what inning it was. but their starters were just razor sharp at the field. You know, they hit if they hit, because they were also, you know, since they were batting early in the game, they were playing against the other teams, you know, from starting, somebody, a starting pitcher they probably will see in the regular season. So. But the Royals looked just, and I saw them twice, and they looked as sharp as you can imagine. I was surprised at how good the Dodgers looked early on, especially considering they have a lot of clubhouse turmoil. Not as much as last year, but they still have a bunch. And they have a very interesting experiment in a very calm, very laid-back new manager who's, you know, his first managerial job is managing the Dodgers in that $200 million payroll.
Did you get to see the team favored by the Padres? I prefer to keep my expectations low, because you saw what happened last year when people actually thought they were going to be good.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Nope. There are trade rumors every day in the local media here, TV or the internet version of the paper, whatever. They're already on such a kick of getting to try and duplicate what the Royals and the Pirates have done in this particular decade, and just throw away virtually everybody they have with a major league contract and build the farm system and build for a good solid championship run in 3 or 4 years down the road. I have my doubts if it works, but it worked for the Royals, kind of worked for the Pirates. I mean, that's not exactly everything they did. I mean, they didn't throw away Andrew McCutchen's contract. They didn't throw away Eric Hosmer's contract in Kansas City, but San Diego, for whatever reason, has just decided they publicly said so. They're not going to be competitive this year.
Did you get to check out the team favored by a certain internet lucha reporter?
I did check out the Cubs. The Cubs were, how will I say it? Their starters looked fine, and the people they brought in after the fourth or fifth inning really looked green, really looked young. And I saw them twice, and it kind of makes me wonder just a little bit if they're not short on depth. And if things go wrong, I mean, I saw this guy, Pierce Johnson, maybe? It's Lincecum Jr. He looks just like Tim Lincecum used to look in his glory days. That is the person that is like the top pitching prospect to the Cubs and stuff like that. And so they cart him out there, and they have him throw some pitches in the first inning against the Angels, and then he's gone at the end of one inning. And it's like, what? How careful do you have to be with somebody that you only take him out after his first inning? He didn't throw a lot of pitches either. They look okay. I am not convinced that they are one injury away from the middle of the pack. If I were in Vegas, I would be right now, which I will be late within the next 7 days, but I'm not now. I would be putting my money on the Pirates for that division, but I can see how the Cubs and certain other teams get lower odds than you would think in Vegas, because they're kind of like a national team, and they have people that will come up from Phoenix and people who are wintering in the Southwest and place bets on them no matter how good or bad they are. There were some teams that looked bad, though, I got to tell you.
Well, I know I heard one national expert on a podcast talk, basically sort of say, like, the American League is so stacked versus the National League now that, you know, teams that win in the low 80s in the American League might be noticeably better than teams in the National League that have 10 more wins, only because the National League is much more top-heavy than the American League is this year.
Yeah, the three best teams I thought I saw while I was out there were the Royals, the Rangers, and the Angels. The Dodgers were close, but granted, they have, even since I've seen them, they've lost a couple of people to injury. So it's going to be a iffy year, but their division's not all that strong to begin with. The big question is the Diamondbacks, and I never saw the Greinke pitch for the Diamondbacks while I was out there. So he is going to be, how he goes is how they're going to go for the season. If he has a 25-win or 20-win season, that's one thing. If because the rest of the team behind him sucks. If he only has a 15-win season, then that's that. The Angels, yeah, I agree. I would agree with that. I would tend to, I think 10 wins, I would maybe say 5 or 6 wins. But generally speaking, I think it's that, to the point where the most depressed fans that I saw were Seattle Mariner fans, because they looked at the Angels and they looked at the Rangers and even the A's, who are going to be better. And they go like, that's 19 games against each one. That's 57 hard, hard games in our division. Then you still have to play the Yankees and the Red Sox and the et cetera, you go on from there. The Royals, the Tigers, the Astros.
Well, that's like the media here in the Mid-Atlantic East Coast is just, you know, it seems like the American League East, you could, you know, pull the names out of a hat in any order, and you could very well be correct. It's like, I wouldn't expect.
Well, not
Toronto.
Not Tampa Bay, but yeah, the other four, yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect, you know, like Toronto to crater, but, you know, they have weird issues now with, you know, Batista and Encarnacion wanting new contracts, and, you know, word starting to leak out that experts seem to think that they're just going, especially with Mark Shapiro in charge, that he's really just going to, like, let them play all year and then walk as free, both of them walk as free agents and take the draft picks because he needs to rebuild. And, you know, those two could very well be at the wrong end of their curve.
I'm beginning to follow you. I'm beginning to think that's not a bad line of thinking too. I suspect the contract that Batista and Encarnacion are going to want would be more than I would be willing to pay.
Well, if you believe the stories if you believe that Batista wants more than 5 years and more than $150 million, it's like, I understand you think you're a physical specimen, Jose, and we'll assume clean that.
You will. Okay.
For the benefit of the argument that you're clean, that, you know, you expect the aging curve to go back to the logical way it should be, not the way it was 10 years ago. And there are people who would say in Toronto that he's already starting to break down. If you look at his injuries last year, I mean, he was out for a couple of weeks or so last year when he got, I think it was in Baltimore, he got upset about something that happened in the game. I don't know if he got thrown at or hit or something weird. And he got so mad, there was a fly ball to the outfield that he gunned into the infield and threw out his shoulder. It's like, you know, that shouldn't be happening to like a 36-year-old.
Yeah, I wouldn't pay. But this year, for this year, I know I remember at the end of last year, all the money that was coming in on Vegas, you know, when the playoffs were down to the 10 teams before they had the one play-in game. The money was coming in heavily on Toronto to win the World Series. I mean, Toronto was getting like 33% of all bets for when 10 teams were eligible. People were just all behind Toronto and that offense and offense and offense and offense. Of course, they went out like 4-1 to the Rangers or 4-2 to the Rangers?
Well, they ended up beating the Rangers and then lost to Kansas City. Because they beat the Rangers in that really weird game that ended with Batista's bat flip.
Yeah. That was a 3-2 series, right? they were down 2-0 and came back and won the last three. Is my memory better on that?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, I mean, that doesn't surprise me because people in Toronto got so crazy for that team, you know, because one, no one wins in Toronto, and two, it had been 20 years since they had won. And you have this new sort of energetic younger fan base that just went gaga over the team. So yeah, so it certainly doesn't surprise me that like all this money went to them. But plus, you know, yeah, it's, you know, it was a team with, they came out of nowhere with, yeah, with lots of offense, and there certainly is a line of thinking that says let these two guys go because they're past the prime, because they still have Tulowitzki, Martin, and Donaldson. That, I mean, those guys all have long, I mean, Tulowitzki and Martin have long-term big-money contracts that you presume wouldn't
plus,
be easy
the, yeah,
to
you know,
leave.
Plus the money they save by not doing those two contracts. I mean, they can go get one superstar.
And, or that money is going to go to Donaldson because they only signed him to a bridge contract.
Yeah, that's true.
Before he went to arbitration. And if he has something that comes close to replicating an MVP season, then, you know, and who's now in the heart of your order and your third baseman and probably going to be the face of your team, that's a guy you're going to want to pay. But we'll see.
We'll see. I just, it's very interesting. I keep, every time I hear about contracts in Canada, Mark, I keep thinking over and over again, these guys are deliberately inflating themselves out so that they don't have to work in Canada before because of the financial implications of, like, being paid in Canada. I don't know if that's true or not. I've heard it alleged in the past that a lot of guys don't like working for Canadian teams in various professional sports.
Well, I think in...
The pay thing? The currency?
Well,
currency
I think...
Thing.
Well... It's funny because, well, I think they don't want to go to Toronto because of the taxes. Because theoretically, in both hockey and baseball, everybody gets paid in American dollars. So if you were actually living in Toronto, and although the dollar is coming back up slowly, but it's still, I think, like in the 70-something cents
range. It's still a great time to take a vacation in Canada if you're an American.
Right, so if you're getting paid, you know, $10 million in Canada, that's, you know, whatever that ends up being Canadian. But then, yeah, you got to pay, you know, crazy. I know the taxes in Toronto are bad, and I know the taxes in Montreal are even worse. Because a popular topic in Toronto has been the whole, will they sign Steven Stamkos from Tampa Bay in the offseason? Because, one, he's from Toronto, and two, they're going to have a huge space under the cap. But the thing is, it's like you would have to pay him over X because you've got all the taxes in Toronto, whereas he plays now in Tampa, and as you know, players love playing in Florida and Texas because there's no state income tax.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you pay a guy $10 million to play in Tampa and you pay him $15 million to play in Toronto, you know, he may actually end up with more money by being in Tampa because of the taxes.
That is true.
Plus in hockey, like a lot of players don't like playing in Canada because they're in a fishbowl, especially in Toronto and Montreal.
I could see that, yes.
I mean, if you're a giant superstar, like, I mean, it's sort of, you know, like the equivalent of being a soccer star. It's like, do you want to be the number one player on the Canadiens and have to, especially if you're French, and live in Montreal and deal with that pressure and have your family deal with that pressure? Because, you know, in Montreal, if you're Carey Price and you give up a goal to lose a game, Not only are you going to hear about it if you stop and get coffee, but if your wife has to go to the grocery store, everybody in Montreal is going to know who Carrie Price's wife is,
Yeah, that's
and or their kids, as opposed to you're a hockey player from Montreal and you play in Nashville
It's true, but I
or
wonder, growing up being Canadian and growing up in Canada, that it's just drilled into your bones that like the highest accomplishment you can make is like starting for the Canadians or starting for the Maple Leafs.
I think
It's like it's just it's it was not quite a U.S. equivalent. You know, it's like starting for the Yankees or starting for the Cowboys or something.
I guess, I mean, if you grew up in Texas and were like a high school quarterback, you may want, like theoretically your dream would be to like play for the Cowboys and win the Super Bowl. But I think nowadays with sort of money and pressure and all, I think if you could, it'd be nice if you're a French Canadian and you could win a cup with Montreal, but if you could win the Stanley Cup with Nashville or the Panthers or Dallas or the Ducks, your name's still on the Stanley Cup, and you get your name on the Stanley Cup if you play for Anaheim, plus you get to live in Anaheim
That's true,
as
although
opposed
there is
to
13% state tax here for high wage earners.
living in Winnipeg in the 3 months when you don't see the sun or whatever else.
Calgary.
That,
The
of
11
course
months
it's
or so
fun.
of the year, it's not Stampede Month.
Of course, I always tell the story. The first time I went to Calgary, I had in February, and I had bought all of this winter clothes for our vacation and whatever. And we get there and it's 45 degrees. And so most of the winter wear was moot. Like we had to take the linings out of our jackets because it was just too hot. Admittedly, the second time I was in Calgary, it was May and the lake was still frozen where we were. So
That's being as far north as London and in the middle of a continent, not in the middle of a continent, but not near the coasts.
right. And lastly, since we've been joking about it all week on social media, Adam LaRoche, doofus.
Hold on. Let me get my 14-year-old kid here. Good to
I don't know. It's
speak. Look, I will go way out on a limb on this, and people can shoot me and like condemn me to the fires of hell for eternity and stuff like this. But I find it very strange that a grown man would need to have his 14 or 12 or 11 or 12-year-old son accompany him to work every single day of his work year.
I just think it seems like more and more layer just weird facets to the story keep coming out that, people on the team saying he was a team leader and that he took drills, like he wasn't just there, he took drills, and I wonder that I think
When I
part of
hear
it
that, buddy,
is
I wonder if there's not something, if he's like, a little mentally slow or a little physically slow or something like that.
well,
If he needs
we
to be
had
watched, because otherwise that's just bizarre to actually not have him be at work, but do the work with your father.
we had talked about this before, and I said when I first heard this story, I figured that the kid had like learning disabilities or physical disabilities, and so he was there all the time, because you've seen that in other sports. You see where, especially like if you're a coach or something like that, or and you have like a needs child, that they'll be around and they'll be part of the team, and you can, so that all makes sense. But none of the stories mentioned that, so I just assumed the only thing that was sort of different in the story was that the kid was also homeschooled, because people kept saying, well, why isn't he in school? Like, was this just for the summer? And it's like, no, it's like all the time. And just, it's that part's weird, and the whole giving up a guaranteed contract is weird.
Yeah, giving
And
up
then there's the theory that,
$13 million just because I can't bring my kid to work every single day. They were,
and then
if I
there's the
understand, they
theory
were
that,
willing to let him come along sometimes, but not every single day.
well, I heard a former player on the radio talking about this, and they said the rule used to be, like in the old days, that families were allowed to come on 2 road trips, and that was it. And presumably, I mean, you always hear stories, especially among second-generation players, of this kid was in the locker room, and we've all seen pictures of Ken Griffey Jr. with the big red machine, or Prince Fielder when he used to follow around Cecil. And so those are the, I think we all know. And Adam LaRoche is, I guess, is a second generation player, so he probably had some experience of being in the clubhouse as a kid,
Yeah.
but this would have been, in the 70s or 80s, whenever. So I guess in a way you could say it's normal for him because that's how he grew up, just not to an extent. But it's just, and then, I read a story that Dirk Hayhurst wrote about how he had similar experiences when he was in the minors. And the story he told was there was a kid who was there all the time who was one of the coach's sons, and I guess, sort of became part of the furniture. And they would always sort of roughhouse and grab ass or whatever in the locker room. And I guess they were doing something one time, and the kid got hurt, I guess, like not seriously, but something roughhousing. And then apparently either the kid or the coach went to the general manager and said, you should cut him for this, cut Hayhurst. And they made Hayhurst apologize to the kid, which seems very backwards to me.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, I'm beginning to appreciate that it's a culture that's not the same as most workplaces and stuff like that. But I, in all my lifetime, I have never seen, to the best of my knowledge, anyone bring their kid to work more than once or twice a year.
Unless it, I mean, other than,
I mean, for any,
mom and
in my
pop.
experience, for any reason, I mean, at all. If the kid's sick, if the kid's whatever, then the employee doesn't come to work. It isn't bring the kid to work with me.
The only time
Obviously, today,
I've,
and you can telecommute much easier than you could in the 70s and 80s. I mean, it's the option of working from home is a viable option for an awful lot of people these days.
well, the only time I, it seems like I see it on a regular basis is one mom and pop slash family operated store. So you have the kids there as like grunts or, learning the business or whatever. Or like I've seen a lot of times in like sometimes in retail, but a lot of times like in restaurants. It's like, especially like if you go in the early afternoon, like after school, you'll see like somebody that's a waiter or waitress, and then like their kid comes in after school, and then they have like dinner there, and then like when their shift's over, they leave. Like that's usually the only time it seems like I've seen that happen
Yeah,
in real
and
life.
now that you bring that up, in my mother's side of the family, going back a ways, there are generations of farmers. And yes, the kid before the stereotypical kid milking the cows before work and then helping with some of the farm work until the sunset after school did in fact happen, but it's going back many generations.
Well, I would actually, well, I would say that goes as far as my generation because I live in the country. And so, yeah, I know plenty of people in school that, yeah, did farm work before they came to school and then went home and did farm work after school. But again, that was still in the 80s. I can't vouch for it now, but I
Yeah.
certainly know.
But we're describing a situation in all these examples where the workplace and the home place is the same place. And in baseball,
Right.
that is not the case. People don't live it, you know, in the upper tier of the stadium.
Although, to bring this full circle, you know, certainly in wrestling, we've also heard these same sort of locker room stories. And, you know, in the old, especially like territory and earlier, you know, where the father is moving from territory to territory, trailing the kids along and the, you know, and the mother and with them. And, you know, we certainly hear stories about, again, probably not every day, but, you know, The Rock tells anecdotes about being in the locker room with his dad and wacky things happening. And I know on Chris Jericho's podcast a week or two ago, Dean Malenko was talking about how they lived in Tampa and going to the Tampa Sportatorium and hanging out and being taught by this and that and this. So, and again, I guess you could, in a way, wrestling's a family business. And certainly in Lucha, wrestling's a family business.
Absolutely.
I like we were saying, it's like on any average CML card, it's like how many families have at least two or more wrestlers on the card? And in, you know, in the Casas
To
family, it's
the
probably
point
like
where we just assume as a fact that being a certain family member is an advantage in getting an employment job there.
and the opposite, where you've heard people say, and I guess people have, you know, said things like this on Informa when they're being interviewed, it's like, you know, people, guys saying, I did not come from a wrestling family, so it was X amount of times harder for me to break into the business than, you know, if, you
If
know, I'm
you
part of the
had been, yeah.
Brazo, yeah, if I'm a Brazo or I'm a Casas or, you know, whomever else. And now that the two families are merged,
Or a member of the Rush family.
well, yeah, somebody joked, what is,
They're
somebody said,
Gonzalez's, but there's a lot of Gonzalez at the CMLL, so you can't really go by just saying the Gonzalez family, so.
well, I think somebody made a joke the other day, like talking about the, going back to the Volador Casas thing, that how it was like family versus family. And it's like, well, now that the Casases and the Brazos are linked, that like somebody in Volador's family is going to need to marry into the like the Parada Morgan family just to stand a chance, and like you have this massive gang warfare between all the families.
Don't put ideas into somebody's head.
Well, isn't, well, I was gonna say,
That'll
isn't,
be the Mexico version of Aztec warfare or Family Feud.
well, because aren't the, 'cause isn't, we're gonna break kayfabe for just a second here, but like isn't Maximo's wife part of one of those
Yeah, I
families?
think she is part of Toronto Morgan family.
Okay. I knew it was somebody. I just didn't. I knew it
And I've
wasn't
heard
the
rumors she's
Casases.
coming back into wrestling, which is a great surprise to me because she was one that everybody had spoken to me about her had said she's this real old school. When you have, you know, the mom in Mexico who has kids, that's it. No work. You raise the kids. So that will be interesting to see if that actually happens.
I was saying, because I don't know of, I guess you have Marcella and Scotty, but I don't know if I could think of sort of like second generation luchadoras off the top of my, I mean, you're much more versed in this history than I am, but.
Luvia is Sangre Chicana's daughter,
Right.
and you've got Goya Kong and Muñeca de Plata, and there's a third one somewhere that I forget her name. Porky has three daughters in the business.
But
Two
do you have very many?
of them are way down. I mean, they work occasionally on independents, if that. Goya Kong used to be a big star, but apparently AAA has no more use for her.
But are there very many instances of mother-daughter, second generation?
Mother daughter. Currently running. I know that Estreita, is it Estreita, is the daughter of one of the, one of the old Diabolicas from the 70s or 80s, has a daughter that's working in CMLL now. I forget if it's Estrellita or Suhegi or who, but yeah, there is one. There is one currently in CMLL, and I think that's the only one.
And now I guess we just have to wait, what, another 4 or 5 years before baby Marvin makes his debut in Lucia?
It won't be long. Actually, it may not be long. Although, once again, you know, Billy Boy is the number of people that have come and gone from the major promotions, and the ones they keep, like, you know, your Lucy Furnos and your Pierre Roth Juniors and your Thunders, it makes you wonder how exactly, this is a topic, I guess, for the next time I'm on, how exactly do people get the job that they get, and why is this person hired instead of that person? That may be the dying question I have as I fade off into the sunset following Lucha, is to of all the questions I never understood is how somebody instead of somebody else gets hired.
So there will be something for the next show.
Hopefully there will be a Winter Palace in our future when we discuss the amazing comeback of the Padres to steal the National League West and head to the World Series.
I would not
to play
holding
the,
my breath.
To play the Baltimore Orioles.
Hopefully by then they'll be back to wearing brown and yellow.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Anything. MLB.com sends me more emails than anybody else places that I registered to that are businesses. They send daily emails, and I see it from different teams and stuff because I bought their spring training tickets, and they must have a racket going where they change everybody's uniforms every year, because I think over the past 10 years I've received several hundred emails just saying, we have new uniforms. We have new uniforms. We have new uniforms. Buy this year's spring training jersey. Buy this year's spring training hat. Now buy this year's regular season batting practice jersey. It's hard to be a fan.
Say,
I feel like MLB, I get nickeled and dimed and begged for money every single day that I open my email.
See, that's at least one of the, if you want to call it this, good things about football, is everybody changes their jersey every year and you just know it. And it's the question of, do you like this year's design that's only slightly tweaked?
Well, if I were Leicester City, I would never change their uniform ever again, since they finally hit upon the lucky one.
But it's, you know, you've got to slightly tweak the way that, I mean, you keep the colors, because God help you if you're a soccer team in Europe and you change your colors. Like, you'll have a revolt, like what happened when, like, Cardiff went from being blue to being red, or vice versa. No, they're the Bluebirds, so they went from blue to red.
Blue to red, yeah.
Because the owner, you know, likes red. You know, because the owner is from Southeast Asia, and red is a lucky color, and so he changed them without knowing that, you know, this team's been around for 150 years, and they're called the Bluebirds, and you change them from blue to red. Luckily, he eventually changed them back, because people didn't like them. I mean, it's like, there's one way to get fans back on your side is, you know, go back to a traditional look. But, I mean, and it's worse in football. In football, you've got at least three kits. It's like you've got the home kit, like you've got the change kit, and then you've got, like, the third marketable, what kind of weird color and design can we make?
Is that the Everton orange one?
Yeah, it's like the, although I have to say that the sort of dark green and orange, oddly, I think actually does not look bad. Although, it's the kind of thing where Everton, being blue and white, really don't need to be wearing, like, dark green and orange.
It is a shock to see. As I noticed,
you know,
the first time I recall seeing it.
Well, last year, either their away kit or their change, either one of the second or third jersey were purple. One year recently, they were white with purple lettering. And then one year recently, they were white with gold lettering. And it's just, but, you know, every 3 or 4 years, then there's one that looks really cool.
So I ask you,
Like,
is
I don't.
it all a money? Is that just deliberately to change things up and to signify a new season and a new start over, et cetera? Or is it purely a mercenary, a money thing? We're trying to get as much money from the hardcore fans as we can.
I think it's just that. Because I understand if you change your, like, if you change your, in Europe, if you change your jersey because your sponsor changes, that's fine because you've got to change the shirt. But, you know, to go from the shirt looks exact, because you can't change it too much or people will complain. But, you know, okay, we're changing the collar from being a V-neck to a polo neck. Or we're changing from one stripe on the sleeve to two stripes on the sleeve. Or if we suddenly become an Adidas team, then we've got to have the Adidas stripes on our jersey because you have to because it's Adidas. You know, I think it's amazing that, I mean, you know, for all the problems I have with like certain with things with American sports. I mean, most of them now have rules that you can't change your uniform like every 2 or 3 years. And so even when you want to, you can't. So that's at least one thing where they're trying to save consumers, I think. Of
Yes, but
course.
you can always bring back retro jerseys from the past and have six or seven basketball games where you wear your retro jerseys from the past and sell those. Man, you got to own this.
Well, and of course now with basketball, now you also have to sell shirts with sleeves.
That's true.
You know,
It never ends. It never ends.
and then you've got your Heritage Night alternates where you can wear your Los Padres jersey, which is kind of redundant.
Yeah, well, yes.
Or
Or the military
Jose.
Padres.
Well, that's all, I mean, to me, especially as a Padres fan, like to me that is the worst. That is like the worst pan, because I am in general not a fan of, you know, what Paul Lucas calls like the G.I. Joe uniform. You know, the between Pinktober and the G.I. Joe uniforms. But yeah, but San Diego being a military town and feeling the either the need to appeal to a demographic or not offend a demographic to like, yeah, to have to wear the camo jerseys like every week.
Yeah, it's supposed to. It used to be on Sundays because Sundays were the day that the military, whoever was not on exercises or whatever, would get together and fill up the outfield, right field, and left field bleachers.
But I mean, that's like, you know, near here, like Cal Ripken's minor league team that is, you know, sits 3 miles from an army base, you know, has a military motif and plenty of gimmicks and jerseys and discounts and what have you. And of course, they're only trying to fill like a 1,000-seat stadium.
That's crazy. We have, I don't know, what is it? Let's say they play 100 games a year, 50 are at home, 50, so they have 50,000 fans total possibility. Let's see if we can have 10 different jersey combinations to try and market. That's crazy. We must do this again, my friend.
Yes. Hopefully, yeah.
Yes, we
Yeah.
won't be. Trust me, we won't be lacking for Lucha news at any point in time during the next 6 to 9 months. I can't imagine very many, if any, weeks that are going to go by without a lot of Lucha news because there's a lot of stuff happening right now. Baseball is baseball. The things that you never expect to happen will, and things that you expect to happen won't. And Strasburg will be traded to the Dodgers, and that's life.
So, are you still writing for Figure Four?
I am, yes.
So, yeah, so people can read your column in the Figure Four weekly newsletter. I know you make regular appearances on Wrestling Observer Live.
Semi-regular.
Should I?
This coming spring should be much more regular.
Should I dare ask the status of your book?
The book is gathering dust, I'm afraid. There's been no great progress on it, sadly. I have no other excuses.
Trust me, I know the feeling. But hopefully there will be an Odessa Steps in the fall, and hopefully we'll find something for you to do.
Well, yes, but of course, if there are people listening who have not read back issues, ooh, I'm in two or three back issues.
I was going to say you're in the Lucha issue from last year with your still great, even however many times they keep repeating it or reprinting it. Your article, oh, again, we'll go full circle. Your great article about how great Negro Casas is, even now as a grandfather, even in his mid-50s,
Even bald.
even as bald as his grandson. Which people may see that picture on this podcast if I can actually get the picture to work right. Isn't it wonderful? Thank you, Steve, for your time.
Super. I look forward to doing it again soon.
Great. And we'll be back after this.